When does a phenomenon become the unknown? When all attempts at understanding fail, and those who thirst for knowledge and understanding watch as research turns to ash in their mouth. As the phenomenon turns from a riddle to be solved into anomalous fascination. Hello, friends. Thank you for tuning in to episode 4 of the Anomalous Fascination podcast. Thank you all so much for the support and kind comments about the show. If you want to know how you can do more, you can hop on Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave a nice 5-star rating and review. Or honestly, the best and easiest thing you can do is just telling someone about the show. Word of mouth is the best way to gain new listeners, and I can't wait to share these things with even more amazing listeners like you. Now, on to the episode. Throughout human history, we have had battles, wars, skirmishes, showdowns, and even staged wars just so each side could show off their fancy new weapons and uniforms. Looking at you, Crimean War. It is no stretch then to say that one of the most rapidly changed, improved, adjusted, or even scrapped creations of humanity is weaponry. Even as the belief systems and scientific understandings of human beings developed in a crawl in the past 2 millennia, weapons produced by society were often seemingly centuries ahead of their time. So, let's rewind back to those very times, to the late 7th century. As land battles, weaponry had been evolving for centuries, whether it be the swords they wielded or new technology for siege warfare. But warfare on the sea had been largely unchanged for quite some time. Sure, the boats may have been built stronger, better, faster, but largely the idea was always the same. Try and ram the boat, or get close, and then attack with crossbows, or by boarding the opposing vessel and fighting with land weaponry. Sure, the occasional new invention was used, but largely naval battle has remained unchanged up to that point. So imagine your surprise when your empire has been working at building and perfecting a navy to not only outnumber, but outmatch your foes. When the day comes and the stage is set, this may even be your first time on a boat, but you get the idea. Get close and then get to work, right? Then imagine coming on an enemy vessel, looking upon the boat and seeing they are vastly outnumbered on deck. But yet, don't seem to be fleeing, just waiting. When you get alongside the enemy vessel, and rather than hearing the whizzing of crossbow bolts or the clanging of swords, you hear a loud and deep grumbling noise as some sort of tube points towards your ship, and you watch as liquid becomes pouring out of it towards your ship, when suddenly your ship, your friends, and anything in its path burst into flame. You suddenly feel a burning sensation as you jump off the side of the ship seeking relief from the flames, as you find yourself several feet deep in the ocean, surrounded by water, still burning, as the ship begins to go under. My apologies for the awful thought, but you get the point. In the late 7th century AD, the Byzantine Empire completely changed the game for naval battle. Well, for themselves at least, as they brought forth a weapon and state secret so devastating that it kept their empire afloat for another 800 years. And what did they call this substance? Greek fire. Let's take a stroll, shall we? So first off, where did the Byzantine Empire come from? The Roman army had succeeded in conquering many territories in the Mediterranean, which, upon settling there, the Romans realized the areas were quite civilized by their standards, as these areas had previously been united under the Macedonian Empire and Hellenized by the influence of Greek culture. There was a lot of instability in the western portion of Rome, which led Emperor Diocletian in 293 CE to create a system called a tetrarchy. in which there would be one co-emperor in Rome and one in the East, which would be called Augustus or Augusti, and each would have a younger colleague called Caesar to share their rule and eventually to succeed the emperor and become an Augustus. Now, if you're still trying to figure out the details about that system I just described, don't worry, because this only lasted about 20 years, when the Tetrarchy collapsed and Constantine I reunited Rome as its sole emperor. 17 years later, in 330 CE, Constantine moved the seat of the empire to Constantinople, the former site of the ancient Greek city, Byzantium. This location was chosen because of its incredible placement between Europe and Asia and access to both the Mediterranean and Black Seas. This would eventually become the sole location of the Roman Empire when, in 476 CE, after numerous attacks over decades, Western Rome fell as a result of an attack where an East Germanic army deposed the Emperor of Western Rome. Now, with that short history lesson out of the way, let's talk about early thermal weaponry. Before the word Greek fire had ever been uttered, incendiary and flaming weapons were being used for centuries. Incendiary arrows, catapulted and thrown pots containing combustible substances, fragile incendiary pots used as crude landmines surrounded with spikes, or even a few times, a long tube on wheels which blew flames forward using large bellows. Yes, really. There were even some early designs almost like something from a James Bond movie. They discovered extremely unstable compounds, which were a viscous liquid in the dark and massive flames under the heat of the sun. This would then be smothered on enemy armaments or even enemy garments late at night. And when the sun comes up the next day, they burst into flame. Which, if I'm being honest, feels like the overcomplicated Rube Goldberg machine of weaponry. But hey, they liked it. Needless to say, the new ideas of weaponry came and went decade after decade, but on occasion, one creation would, against all odds, have real staying power. In the 7th century AD, the Byzantine Empire was in dire straits. It was weakened by its long wars with Persia, and the Muslim conquests were setting their sights on Constantinople after building an imposing naval fleet. It was at that time that a Greek-speaking Jewish refugee named Callinicus of Heliopolis arrived in Constantinople after fleeing the Arab conquests of Syria around 672 CE. Callinicus was an artificer, and being aware of the impending tax by the Arabs, presented the emperor with a concoction he had created. It became known as Greek fire. Named either for the Greek-speaking Callinicus or because Callinicus drew inspiration from a 1st century BCE Greek weapon. There is some question of whether a lesser form of Greek fire had existed in Byzantium a few years before, and this was simply the final improvement to make its true form, but for our purposes, not terribly important. What is important, however, is this creation would not only push back the Arab attacks in the late 7th century, but it would lead to Byzantine dominance at sea for centuries. So what exactly did Greek fire do and how was it used? It had numerous ways of being deployed, which is one of the reasons that Greek fire, true Greek fire, had so much staying power. Its primary function, which set it apart from all similar substances, was that it was projected through a tube or siphon with a controllable nozzle. Picture a fire hose, except... No, I think this device is actually more deserving of the title fire hose, so we'll stick with that. Because when the nozzle opened, it spewed forth a thick viscous liquid that would stick to everything and instantaneously catch fire. These siphons would be used mostly in naval battle, as that was the majority of their battles due to strategic location on land, but they also discovered it could be converted for use in sieges of heavily guarded fortresses. Just throw up a siege tower, stick the siphon over the top of the fortress, and let fire rain down on everything. I'm sure the world was grateful for the fact that the Byzantine Empire spent most of its time on defense rather than on offense. Other uses included jars filled with Greek fire and caltrops, which are sharp, sticky metal things. These would be thrown by both catapults and in smaller forms by hand. And similar to being used for siege weapons, siphons would be installed on castles or fortresses owned by the Byzantine Empire to wipe out invading sieges or, possibly more important, as deterrent for invaders who knew of Greek fire. Kind of like the antiquity version of ADT. So you might be thinking, well, at least this is happening on water, so people could save themselves from burning alive. Well, Unfortunately not. Another significant element of Greek fire was that not only did water not put it out, but it burned with equal intensity on solid or liquid surfaces, which meant that not only would the sea not put out the fleeing combatants, but oftentimes non-ignited combatants would go to jump in the water, only to find that the water itself around the boat had ignited as well. I'd be curious to learn if anyone ever wised up and started carrying baking soda. Joking, of course. But interestingly enough, there were some reports by Arabians who experienced Greek fire that claimed the sticky liquid would not adhere to heavy cloth or leather that had been soaked in vinegar. I would be willing to guess that not many volunteers were lining up to test that theory. Now, of course, Greek fire was not the end-all be-all of weaponry. It obviously was extremely effective and helped the empire survive and expand for centuries, but it had some shortcomings in naval battle. For one, it didn't have a terribly long range, which had not been an issue early on, but opposing forces began devising new plans of attack. Although Greek fire, true Greek fire, as there would be many knockoffs for centuries after, was the most effective of its kind, there were other flammable liquids and methods of catapulting that would eventually allow forces to keep their distance from Byzantine ships. Additionally, the Byzantine ships had another concern when out on the open sea. Greek fire. Yes, that's right. Their own Greek fire. With calm waters and favorable wind conditions, Greek fire worked like a dream. But add some turbulence or a strong gust and, well, let's just say it must have been a sight to see to watch a Byzantine ship accidentally spit into the wind, as they say. As mentioned briefly earlier, the term Greek fire would be used by many other civilizations over the next 700 years, none of which truly matched actual Greek fire. Numerous sites in the Crusades, for example, would claim their own versions of Greek fire, which would later be discovered to not match most characteristics of true Greek fire, as it largely could only be used by being thrown via catapult and lacked the potency of true Greek fire. Over the centuries of fighting off and on, the Arabs would often capture Byzantine boats and secure the siphons and even some of the substance. But despite this, they were never able to successfully recreate the substance or even get it to work. Additionally, the term Greek fire was used often, but in Byzantium, they tended to call it by many other names, before many other languages generalized the term Greek fire. Byzantines would call it by many names including sea fire, Roman fire, war fire, liquid fire, sticky fire, or even manufactured fire. And perhaps the most famous present-day reference of a version of Greek fire is wildfire in Game of Thrones, which produced horrifying green flames that burnt in much the same way as Greek fire. So you may be thinking, well, yes, this is very interesting, but it seems a bit different than most of this show's subject matter. So why am I covering this? Stay tuned after this short break to find out more. So the question is, what happened to Greek fire, and when was it last used? Well, after Callinicus provided the ingredients and directions on how to use it, the only person who had possession of that information was the emperor of the Byzantine Empire. Obviously, the ingredients and manufacturing methods were passed from emperor to emperor over multiple centuries, but what happened to it after that? Well, see, that's the thing. Nothing happened to it after that. The instructions for creating Greek fire were lost to the ages. So, did anyone try recreating Greek fire? Well, obviously, as we discussed, many empires tried to recreate it, but could never get it quite right. But regarding years following the disappearance of the Byzantine Empire in the 1400s, there have been numerous attempts at recreating the substance, whether for battle or just pure curiosity. The problem is, they had a few ideas of what could have been in its composition, but never got quite the mixture or effect described in writings and drawings of Greek fire. Scientists have since come to believe that either petroleum or naphtha, don't ask, was the key ingredient. Beyond that, they only have guesses. Quicklime, sulfur, resin, potassium nitrate, and some have even suggested the earliest form of gunpowder, due to its described loud booming sound. Although, most scholars were quick to dismiss that thought, as that would be hundreds of years before it was first created in China. And though they suspect petroleum was likely used in the substance, scholars also agree that the distillation process of petroleum would have required some extremely advanced technology for the time. So here's the answer to the question before the break, as to why we would be discussing this. Because as of the year 2020, when this is being recorded, despite numerous attempts over the centuries, no one has been able to recreate Greek fire. Now, some might say it's in large part because of the limited information to go off of to recreate it. But I like to think it's just one of those things that was so far ahead of its time that we couldn't possibly begin to understand how they could have created it. Pretty cool, huh? Thank you all once again for listening to the Anomalous Fascination podcast. If you want to follow the show, hit the subscribe button on the app of your choice so you never miss an episode. Or follow me on Twitter at AnomalyPod or email me at AnomalousFascination@gmail.com. And once again, thanks for listening.